proudly through my window today. Could have tripped out DC, but I've changed my way. It'll take time, I know it, but in a while you're gonna be mine, I know it. We'll do it in style, 'cause I made my
Hey, it's John Amundson, and I want to welcome you to the next podcast in the series of podcasts presented for you by the Psychologists Association of Alberta. The purpose of the podcast is to present information that's timely, topical, and even controversial to the membership. I was reviewing a bunch of articles today, and so I'm literally often I stockpile the articles and then go back through and say, throw this one away. Yeah, this one's probably still worth doing, on and on. But there were so many just really exciting. I use the word cool way too often, but you know, some really, really cool articles. And so I'm going to kind of run through a whole potpourri of things. There's a central focus on this, which has to do with our mind and the way our mind works and thoughts, and especially this stuff with psychedelics. You guys have humored me, and good-naturedly, I hope, listened to the old hippie talk over and over about the emerging issues around the use of psychedelics, both positive and negative. But there's a couple of other things that came up today that are just way too good to sit on and not record. Okay, so let me jump right in, because you know, I often say to you guys, there are terms now that you can use to impress your friends, right? And psychologists are always marketing ideas. Yeah, one of my greatest hits has been, gosh, if we could only buy futures in some of these concepts, you know, we would all be very, very wealthy. All right, so the one today, the term to impress your friends, is a descriptive phrase called contaminated mindware. I just love that. It's in the Journal of Psychology of Religion and Spirituality, APA Journal. And what they define this term as is it's compromise in critical thinking, in reasonable skepticism, reasonable empirical sorts of thoughts about things. And so contaminated mindware pertains to people who are highly invested in beliefs, paranormal, pseudoscience, and conspiracy beliefs. And all of us have run into these folks. And you watch, if you start talking to them, almost all three of these things line up, you know, just bizarre and unusual conglomeration of thoughts that often defy rationality. I was watching, I'm embarrassed, it's one of these things I look at and then I hate to say I've looked at them, but they were interviewing Trump people, right? And they were interviewing this guy in a line waiting to go in one of his rallies. And they said, good, tell me a little bit about your support for Donald Trump. And he said, law and order. The man believes in law and order, and I believe in law and order. And then he pontificated. He said, without law, without adherence to the law, we have chaos. And that's what our cult, what our society needs right now, is law and order. And so then the guy said to him, so you support these findings from the courts, civil findings regarding his, I think it's $284 million fine that was found through the courts and through law and order. And there's this long pause, and the guy says, that's a loaded question. And the guy says, no, I just, you know, you've said law and order, and so I just wondered if then you support the use of the law and the structure of the law to deal with issues, and as what they found with Donald Trump. And the guy just became angry, shut up, and walked away. Now, that's an example of what this article would call contaminated mindware, this idea of, again, paranormal pseudoscience, but conspiracy beliefs are adherence to ideas that are logically inconsistent and incompatible. So there's a term you can use, and you can use it as a slur to throw on people and say, oh, you suffer from contaminated mindware. All right, so that article I just could not help but bring up today. Now moving on, the other article that popped up has to do more directly with the psychedelic drug stuff that we're seeing coming. And it was in the Experimental and Clinical Pharmacology Journal from APA. And they talk about psychedelic integration. And we know that in most of the program, if you read the advertising for these programs, it says you will be guided, you will be assisted, there will be a pre and post use of professionals or paraprofessionals or shamans or whoever to help you integrate the experience. And they raise this as a pressing concern for professionals, for psychologists who are going to be involved in this, because what they say is there is psychedelic assisted therapy, and that PAT, and then there's psychedelic integration. And their concerns about the integration part is that the vehicles for integration range from sort of indigenous practices, that is the traditional medicine, traditional medicine practices, through, I just listed some of them, Jungian, trauma-based, cognitive behavioral, trance-theoretical, and a really interesting one, which was called internal family systems approach. And I looked real quick at that article that they cited, and it's this person who says, well, we are a multiplicity inside, and so when we integrate, we can integrate in the same way we would do in family therapy. See, in family therapy, they talk about the systemic aspects of the problem, that the problem is based on more than just the internal predispositions of the individual. So they raise this psychedelic integration as a problem. And they have said that if we're going to move forward with these treatments, there are a number of things we should address. And I'm not going to go through the list of 12 or 14, but essentially they think we need to define what psychedelic integration is, to evaluate the methods that are being employed, to look at the traditional versus new forms of integration, say, shamanistic kinds of things versus cognitive behavioral integration. They talk about looking at who are we talking about? Are we talking about men, women? Are we talking about older people, younger people? Are we talking about anxiety, depression? Are we talking about just enhancement? There are people who want to take these medicines, not because of any particular problem, but just simply for the voyage and the exploration. They talk about a pre- and post-evaluations relative to integration. In other words, what preparation is given ahead of time that would have to do with integration, and then what happens afterwards with integration, so that they're looking at the predispositions that would exist when one has done the pre and the post. Anyway, it goes on and on. They want to do qualitative evaluations, so they're talking to people who, did this in a large ceremony. Because there are circumstances where that is taking place, or at a retreat versus in a single session in an office with a single practitioner. So anyway, I think it's a really a good article, and I'm hoping that individuals who are exploring this will begin to look at this as an area for us in Alberta, because if all of a sudden all you guys out there, all you day trippers, decide that you're going to do this, get together and come up with an integrative model that may become the Alberta model of psychedelic integration. All right, so let me move on to one more article and then we'll call it a day. Actually, I deceived myself. I have two more articles, but I'll do this one really quick. There was a quick popular article out on what they call trip killers. And trip killers are when people use, when they use benzodiazepines to knock down a bad trip. Let me take a second and I'll collect my wits about this. First, the use of benzodiazepines as trip killers is nothing new. When we were hippies, we would always have some Valium around, and especially when the experience extended beyond what we thought was useful for us or enjoyable, so you could bring people down. But they're talking about this being a more common practice among informal psychedelic users, and then also informal circumstances. Again, the cautionary stuff is there, that when there is anxiety and one turns to these powerful trip killers and anxiety killers, there can become a fascination and a dependence. In another domain, these trip killers can also be narratives. And in a study out of Norway, they found that when people have had a bad trip, if we spend the time going back to psychedelic integration, that the bad trip, through the development of an enabling narrative, can also then become a beneficial or a positive experience. So rather than just people being stuck with, oh my God, I thought I was dying, the narrative generated around that experience can bring relief and even an enlightening and beneficial effect. And now, speaking of trip killers and a bit of a buzz kill, I wanted to mention one other article that I was able to find. You know, the difficulty with all this research is to get the psychedelic or the treatment vehicle, you know, whether that's MMDA or psilocybin or ketamine, to get that out of the placebo sort of expectancy domain. And I read an article that talked about doing this. There's only been one sort of, apparently only one that I have, has been brought to my attention. The guy that brought it to my attention said, it was in a popular article, he said this is the only randomized trial of ketamine that has been masked that he was able to find. And it was a very interesting study. What they did is they looked at patients with major depression who were scheduled for surgery. And in the surgery, ketamine is used as a part of a anesthesia protocol. As a matter of fact, I've had it a couple of times, and it was pretty cool. We'll go up this alley just for a second. My first hip I had replaced, I had a spinal. So I was pretty much conscious and aware. They used midazolam and ketamine. And so in the procedure, I was kind of aware of what was going on, quite out of it, and in quite a lovely way, quite enjoyed it. All right, so I understand a little bit about the impact of ketamine in general, and especially the concept of ketamine as vitamin K used in nightclubs and for recreational purposes. Anyway, back to the main street here. The randomized trial of ketamine masked by surgical anesthesia. So what they did is they took these people with major depressive disorders that were having surgery, just a coincidental sort of covariance. These two things came together. And they some got ketamine, some didn't, because ketamine is it's not a routinized or a standard of practice for surgery. They can use other things. So what they did is they gave a single dose of intravenous ketamine during the anesthesia, all right? So these people are unconscious, so they're not having an immediate effect. In other words, it's not like, oh boy, I'm feeling different. And what they found was there was no greater effect than placebo in accurately reducing the severity of depressive symptoms. In other words, they said to them, double-blind mask, and they masked this even to the surgeons and everybody involved. Afterwards, they then evaluated. They asked them first, do you think you had it, didn't you? And then they asked them about the reduction in depression. And I'm not quite sure how they did that, whether that was with an objective measure or qualitatively. But what they found was there was no greater effect than a placebo in reducing the severity of depressive symptoms. And I called this a buzz kill, a trip kill, because, this was a chance to really look at independent impact of ketamine. See, we all want to essentialize things, that our method of treatment, whether that is our psychotherapeutic method or our biomedical treatments, has an essentialist quality, meaning you do this, it causes this. So this kind of puts ketamine in that expectancy domain, and Amundsen's old chestnut, a placebo with a main effect will have a greater impact than a placebo without an effect. All right, so let me get some music and we'll march you guys out.
My lips, even messing with my children, and you're screaming at my wife.